The following is a special presentation of Tony Curry Radio. Want the real story behind the sound bites and headlines? Let's find the facts. Remember, it's not a conspiracy theory if it's the truth. You are not paranoid or confused. You just need to know.
Welcome in, everybody. It's a brand new week of Everything You Need to Know. I'm Kip Kiefer and glad to be with you as always. Appreciate everybody on Tony Curry Radio that tunes in every week and hears what we have to say. And as we always preface the program, we like to let everybody know who might be listening for the first time that this basically is a exchange of ideas in terms of bringing some light to some things that maybe are not in the public discourse, hopefully presenting some things that you can think about and make your own conclusions instead of being kind of pushed and coerced in the direction that a lot of influence peddlers out there would like you to go. If we can convey one thought or idea every week, or hopefully more than that, that will allow your thinking process to process some more information that maybe is not available to you in other circles, that is the goal of the program. There's several things. I promised a segment today, and I'm certainly going to include that because I can always keep my promises. Going to try to explain just the basics of a very confusing story that I'm sure most of you have been brought up to date with in terms of just general headlines and people talking about it. But the whole scandal with the FTX Corporation, which basically was a cryptocurrency exchange. Now, I'm going to be the first to admit, I have a very difficult time grasping the concept of cryptocurrency. So if you're looking for a thorough explanation on that, I am not the guy that's going to be able to provide that for you, because I, as much as I read and study these things and have asked a lot of people that are involved in it, including my youngest son, who is a big cryptocurrency investor from day one, probably 8 or 9 years ago, to give me a basic explanation, I still can't really grasp the concept of digital currency. But that's just a little bit of a part of the story on the FTX collapse and its founder, Sam Bankman-Fried, which hereafter today on the broadcast, we're going to call him what his real name should be, Sam Bankman-Fraud. I don't know if anybody's used that. That might be my creation, but it's just too tempting to pass up in light of everything that's happened. Before we get into that, I wanted to also talk about two of the other big stories of the weekend. And as you know, I'm heavily involved in the sports side of things. Right here on Tony Curry Radio every week, we have Wanna Bet, our show out of Las Vegas. It's myself and my son, Case Kiefer, who is the sports editor of the Las Vegas Sun in Nevada. He was in the press box yesterday at Allegiant Stadium covering the Raiders-Chargers game. He is on the NFL beat with the Raiders every week, home and away. So he's kind of living the dream and getting to tour all the stadiums around the country and catch all the Raiders action and report back to all of his constituents in Las Vegas. But Case has also become one of the foremost football wagering experts in the country, particularly on NFL football. He went 2-1 with his picks yesterday and really was unlucky not to hit the other one. He had the New York Giants over the Washington Commanders, and all he needed was the field goal in overtime that fell short, and that game ended up in a rare 20-20 tie in the NFL. He hit his other two picks yesterday, but I preface all that because I want to talk a little bit about the big sporting news of the weekend, which on Wanna Bet and our radio programs broadcast here in Birmingham, we spend a lot of time on college football, of course, because in this part of the country, college football is king. I don't think anybody can deny that in terms of interest and support in the Southeast. And this weekend, People are coming to grips with the fact this morning that the Alabama Crimson Tide, for just the second time in the history of the college football playoff procedure, are not amongst the teams selected. Now, that's a big deal because Alabama turned out to be the number five team in the final college football poll. That means they missed it by one spot because they needed some chaos this weekend. You had an undefeated TCU team in the Big 12 championship game. If they won and stayed undefeated and were the conference champion, they were going to be an automatic lock to get in the playoff. You also had Southern California out in the West Coast, and USC under new coach Lincoln Riley, who bolted from Oklahoma, brought his quarterback with him and a bunch of other players. USC had a chance to wrap up the Pac-12 championship against the only team that had defeated them all year, Utah, and they did not get it done, to say the least. Utah just boat raced them in the second half and won that game, essentially knocking USC out of the playoff. TCU on Saturday played gallantly against Kansas State, a team they had beaten early in the year. But unfortunately for Horned Frog fans, they did not get the job done in the Big 12 title game, losing in overtime after some unfortunate play calling down around the goal line by their coaching staff. Their quarterback, Max Duggan, did everything a human being could possibly do. He was a one-man show. He had run himself to exhaustion, bringing and willing TCU back from behind, as they've done so many times this year. But they came up short at the goal line on a fourth down try, and Kansas State was able to kick the winning field goal. However, yesterday in the selections, that chaos only yielded one change in the top four, as TCU getting credit for their five wins over ranked teams this year and their undefeated status until Saturday, still stayed in the number three spot in the final rankings behind undefeated Georgia, undefeated Michigan, one loss TCU, and the fourth member of the college football playoff in a probably a decision between Ohio State and number five Alabama. Ohio State gets that spot. They've got one less loss than Alabama, albeit it was a terrible loss. Their last game against Michigan, they were absolutely destroyed in their own stadium, outscored 28-3 in the second half of a game that was tied 20-20 at halftime. 48-23, the final score in that game, an absolute blowout for the Michigan Wolverines, who, as mentioned, are the number two team, wrapping up the Big Ten title on Saturday night against a four-loss Purdue team. So that's your playoff. You've got Georgia playing Ohio State in Atlanta on New Year's Eve, and out in Phoenix, Arizona, earlier in the day, it will be the matchup between TCU and number two Michigan. Alabama fans are kind of up in arms. They certainly had a strong case why they deserve to go instead of Ohio State. But at the end of the day, that one extra loss, Alabama, of course, losing in overtime at LSU on a two-point conversion pass by ordered up by Coach Brian Kelly and the Tigers, doomed the Crimson Tide, who had already lost earlier in the year to Tennessee. And I made the point on my radio show yesterday that Alabama fans really should have been resigned to this, because after losing to Tennessee, there was really no margin for error. They really had to run the table on the rest of their games, and they did not get that done. It was a heartbreaking defeat at LSU, but that ultimately is what did them in. Now, the simplistic part of that that bothers me is the fact that people are saying, well, you know, we have two undefeated teams and two one-loss teams, so those are the teams that belong in the playoff. But if that's the criteria, why do we fly people, all these committee members, to the Gaylord Resort in Grapevine, Texas, which is outside Dallas, every weekend for 6 weeks so they can vote on this thing and select teams? If it's just based on wins and losses, no matter who you play or what conference you're in or how you've performed, if it's just wins and losses, why do we need a committee to consider this? You could make that decision by, you know, getting online and seeing who won and lost each week. and saying, okay, we got two undefeateds and 2-1 losses, so they're the teams in the playoffs. That's absolutely absurd to me. So much of it has to be based on resume and who you played and how you played and how you won and how you lost. And that is just not being put in the formula. The good or bad news, depending on how you look at it, is that we only have to put up with this four-team system for one more year, because finally there was a breakthrough this week and all parties agreed to forfeit contractual obligations and all different commitments. The Rose Bowl was the last holdout, insisting that they would be able to retain the New Year's Day 5:00 Eastern time, 2:00 Pacific time slot, and also get to preserve the tradition of primarily inviting Big Ten against Pac-12 teams. College football playoff folks said, Rose Bowl, if those are your demands, it's been nice knowing you, but no, we're not doing that this time. You're either in our system or you're out. And if you're out, that means you don't get to host any of the playoff games and you don't get any of the revenue, the unbelievable amount of revenue this is going to generate. In a 12-team playoff, you get nothing. And so the Rose Bowl, of course, blinked and relented. Everybody's in, and that playoff, instead of starting in 2026, will now begin in 2024. So only one more season with the four-team model. And the problem with this year's four-team model is Georgia 13-0, Michigan 13-0, and then teams basically 3 through 7 or 8, you could make a strong case for almost all of those because none of them have the perfect resume. All of them have losses. None of them won their conference championships. So, you know, you could have actually put those names in a hat and drawn two more teams out the way it shook out. So this year, this four-team model did not work at all in terms of a logical four teams, and it's going to be forever embroiled in controversy. So that's the basic story there. Those games, once again, New Year's Eve, that's correct, day and night, you're going to have Michigan and TCU and Georgia and Ohio State in a very compelling matchup at Mercedes-Benz Stadium. So that's your sports report to start things off. The other big story of the weekend was the release by Twitter, new executive and owner, majority stockholder Elon Musk, of internal documents from Twitter that revealed the company's strategy and collusion with the news media and U.S. government officials in the 2020 election to completely suppress any story on the Hunter Biden laptop. Now, I think you recall, if you are a regular listener to Need to Know, Terry Quillian and I had a full-scale examination of the Hunter Biden laptop story earlier in the series and basically explained there was never any controversy about whether this was legitimate. It's been in the FBI's hands since 2019. There have been many people that have come forward with their side in terms of what their transmissions were from Hunter Biden. The whole suggestion this was Russian, quote, disinformation was just something cooked up by people that were trying to protect the chances of Joe Biden winning the presidency and did not want this to get into the public consciousness just weeks before the election. And they suppressed the story. And now Elon Musk has come forward with documentation of Twitter's involvement with the FBI, who had come forward and said, this is disinformation. It needs to be suppressed and censored. They literally, these documents show, cut off people that were wanting to talk about it, did not allow their material to be seen. Again, I had personal experience in this because I knew full well what was going on. And my subscribers, all of a sudden, mysteriously, my followers went from about 3,000 down to about 1,000. 2,000 of my followers just seemingly disappeared because I was talking about things that they did not want me to talk about. And, you know, it's a private company. They have the right to do that. But on the other hand, they also do not have that right because this was billed as a public square situation where you put an idea out there, people agree or disagree. There's discussion. And Twitter has federal government protection, like Facebook and other social media companies, that they cannot be sued. They cannot be liable for their decisions in these situations because they are supposed to be strictly a messaging entity, not a publication or, you know, some kind of journalistic ethics outfit where they determine the validity of a story. They are supposed to be a public forum, and they have that government protection based on that designation. But what they have done and until now has been anything but a public square forum and a, you know, free speech opportunity for Americans. So that was an interesting story that's come out. My big reaction to that is the following. I did not learn anything I did not already know. If you read a lot and you follow these stories and you see that the way these events kind of transpire, your own common sense and logic will dictate a lot of times your conclusions on what was going on. And the fact that there's substantiating documentation now to verify that information of what I just described tells me not very much, because these are conclusions I already made based on my own research and my own experience in this process. So I was not blown away. I applaud Elon Musk because he says we got to get all the dirty laundry out of this company that I've just acquired before we can get to square one and turn it into what it was intended to be, not some political indoctrination and censorship organization, but a wide open forum for people to discuss what's on their mind and to debate the issues back and forth. So that was the other big story of the weekend, the Elon Musk Twitter revelations. All right, let's get into this story about Sam Bankman-Fried, who I like to refer to as Sam Bankman-Fraud. If you're not familiar, his corporation, FTX, about 2 weeks ago went belly up, declared bankruptcy. He resigned as chief executive officer and is a disgraced individual today. Sam Bankman-Fraud, if you really want to get into a full description, is an odd character. He's 30 years old, 30, born in 1992, just a young guy who, you know, is the son of two Stanford law professors, both very far left, very progressive. So Sam Friedman grew up in that environment. He had a lot of indoctrination in terms of his thoughts and the way he thinks about things. But he also was given a lot of gifts in terms of his senses of how to succeed, not just on his abilities, but the things to do to maximize his opportunity to really make a big score. He went to the Massachusetts Institution of Technology, better known as MIT, and actually was a physics major and came out of there with a degree. And that's very laudable, of course. But he immediately got involved with a lot of people in the financial industry and started a firm in 2017 that started all this called Almeida Research. And Almeida Research was basically created as a hedge fund investment firm to make major and what most people would call, quote, risky, unquote, investments in not only national, you know, Wall Street issues, but also on a lot of foreign markets, on foreign currencies and lands. A lot of that's based on in the hedge fund industry, betting, I guess, against the flow to some extent. Utilizing contacts and information to anticipate events that are coming. George Soros, when he made one of the most famous hedge fund investments against the Bank of England years ago, when they were getting ready to make some major monetary changes to their investment strategies and whatnot, and George Soros cashed in big. To this day, he is known as the man who broke the Bank of England. But Bankman-Fried got into this, again, on the side of being an investment firm for hedge funds, which attracts a lot of big money investors with the promise of the opportunity to make huge scores. And the problem with that is it requires a lot of currency to be able to pump into the process. So that's why the FTX Corporation was founded, because they needed money for Almeida research. They had a lot of investors, but they needed their own capital. And they saw an opportunity, he saw an opportunity to get into this cryptocurrency industry and basically create an exchange situation with other firms that were doing the same thing, kind of like the stock market, buying and selling different kinds of cryptocurrency, making investments, and soliciting, big participation from a lot of people that were really a believer in digital currency and its future. And that wheeling and dealing paid off big time, because they attracted thousands of investors, about $2 billion in capital over a couple of years to fund the FTX effort, and had spectacular success in buying and selling cryptocurrency with other firms and investors around the world. So FTX became this giant firm. Sam Bankman-Fried, personal wealth ballooned to about $26 billion, which is inconceivable to think about. A young guy with not that much experience having that kind of success. He bought an entire building in the Bahamas that became the world headquarters, but really it was occupied and people he lived there along with a bunch of his friends. He was on the cover of Forbes and Fortune magazines, hailed as this boy genius who worked 24 hours a day and hardly ever left his office. They were creating the legend that Bankman-Fried was actually sleeping on a beanbag in his office when he did have to rest a little bit. A lot of that was all crafted not so much on accomplishment, but on the fact that he was spreading money around to all the appropriate places, publishing companies that had various publications, the conventional media outlets, and also just buying influence because he was in with the right crowd. His mother had had a foundation for years that funded major left-wing causes and candidates, and Bankman-Fried jumped right into that same category, becoming the second biggest donor to predominantly Democrat candidates and causes, and that really got him in good graces with a lot of people that are charged with regulating the industries of securities and exchange, including the illustrious Maxine Waters, the chairman of the House Finances Committee, the Finance Service Committee, who would be the entity in Congress who would be in charge of keeping an eye on what's happening there, not to mention the Securities and Exchange Commission, which has always been an interesting entity, again, with a left-wing administration and a lot of people that he was just pumping millions and millions of dollars in. He was, the second biggest donor behind George Soros, who is legendary for that kind of activity. Sam Bankman-Fried was invited to all kinds of high brow banquets and got all kinds of awards and honors for his tireless work in trying to support different health entities that were trying to suppress the pandemic, also hailing the necessity for massive financing unbelievably zealous efforts on the great existential threat we all face in climate change. He was just the golden boy for the far left in terms of being one of the main financiers, pumping money into just about anything and everything. The problem was he was pumping that money in from the profits and the investments he was securing for FTX. So, and as I mentioned, FTX was created to be a fundraising operation and to create money to continue to feed Alameda Investment, and Alameda Research was the name of the firm. And his girlfriend and one of his cohorts in the Bahamas animal house operation masquerading as a corporate headquarters. Her name was Caroline Ellison. She had kind of taken on the ownership and day-to-day operation of Alameda, which was, again, making very risky investments and needed a lot of capital. And once again, the money coming out of FTX from all the currency exchanges and investors they were drawing was the thing funding that. So the money was spread around. The problem was it wasn't their money to do that with. It was improper. And it all collapsed eventually because in any Ponzi scheme, and that's basically what this amounts to, you're always soliciting new investment by showing people how successful the previous investors have been. But the reason the previous investors are now being successful is simply because of the fact that they're drawing in new money to dish out. And eventually, when the money stops, the whole thing collapses. Anyway, Bankman-Fried now has had a couple of interviews, and he's kind of shrugged and said, you know, this is all unfortunate. I'm really sorry. I feel terrible that a lot of people have lost a lot of money. But I did not intentionally commit fraud. I really didn't know what was going on. I didn't know if so much money out of FTX was being funded to Alameda. I should have worked harder. I should have spent more time on risk management, which is basically taking steps to invest money in some safer investments to protect risky investments. He just said, basically, I feel bad, but I love these words. He said, I just got cocky. I thought we had it made, and I stopped working hard, and I stopped paying attention, and I wish things were different. But he is just kind of shrugging it off as, you know, this is just bad luck. He's gone from net worth supposedly, and who knows how much is hidden away, of $26 billion to revealing in that interview last week with ABC and George Stephanopoulos that he's down to just $100,000 in net worth. Think about that, folks. His personal worth was reported at $26 billion just a year and a half ago. Now he's saying he's only worth personally $100,000. That might be the biggest fall from grace and financial grace in the history of American business. So Sam Bankman-Fried, 30 years old, we will see now because the light has shined brightly on all the people he's been financing and funding and all of these oversight committees, the Securities and Exchange Commission, the House Financial Services Committee. A lot of them are the recipients of big money from Sam Bankman-Fried, and what are they going to do next? That's going to be very interesting to watch unfold. He's still not arrested. He's still down in the Bahamas. You would think on a case of this magnitude, he would already have been extradited back to the United States, and that's a big fear that he will soon disappear to a country where they can't extradite him because of no treaty. But it's going to be a fascinating story to follow. That's just an overview and some of the basics on the Sam Bankman-Fried story. So as you hear details, I wanted to fill in some of the blanks and maybe have you gain a better understanding. He's been called Mini Madoff because you remember Bernie Madoff, the New York socialite, had a massive Ponzi scheme going that really drained a lot of money from a lot of people. And I don't know if you can call him Mini Madoff. This guy looks like the comic strip character Nancy. Nancy, of course, was a comic strip that started in the 1920s and lasted almost 100 years. The character looks amazingly like Sam Bankman-Fried with his poofy kind of hair sticking out on the sides. And I'm telling you, if you ever saw that comic or if you look it up, he looks like a total clone of the comic strip character Nancy. But he's sorry. He didn't mean it. It wasn't fraud. He just made mistakes. He didn't work hard enough. So no harm, no foul. Sorry, folks that are out hundreds of thousands of dollars. It's just one of those things. That's all the time we have this week. I hope we had some interesting content that sparks some thoughts in your head as you look into this some more. But now you have some basics in the story that really we've kind of just jumped right into the gist of what's going on. Without getting a lot of reports on the background, I wanted to fill in some of those gray areas for you as you hear more about this unfolding. I'm Kip Kiefer. It is always such a pleasure to be on Tony Curry Radio and come to you each week on Need to Know. Don't miss Wanna Bet this week as we discuss what's happening in the college football playoffs and all of the bowl games coming up. It's the most wonderful time of the year. Have a great week, everybody.
This has been a special presentation of Tony Curry Radio.